month. One for Dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Politics in the Pub, brought to you by the Australia Institute.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast, demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Rod Campbell, the Research Director at the Australia Institute, and I'm filling in for Ebony Bennett, who is currently hiking the Pacific Crest Trail as you listen to this podcast. I jumped into Ebony's very big hiking boots to host a recent Politics in the Pub about the Murray-Darling Basin.
I'm pretty excited about hosting Politics in the Pub. I didn't think that the Institute would let me do it again. The last time I hosted it in Adelaide, it ended with a fair bit of heckling from the crowd. The time before that, in Darwin, it ended with legal threats and angry phone calls from the editors of well-known Northern Territory newspapers. I'd like to particularly thank Ebony for not being here and giving me another chance at hosting this wonderful event.
But seriously, the Murray-Darling Basin, it's fair to say, is one of the biggest environmental stuff-ups in Australian history, and the current drought is only making matters worse. This is not only a story about water, this is a story about numbers. Big numbers. $13 billion of federal government taxpayer funds has been set aside to fix Australia's biggest river system, the Murray-Darling Basin. The river runs from Queensland through New South Wales, Victoria, to South Australia, but unfortunately, irrigation siphons off so much along the way that barely a dribble makes it to the ocean in South Australia, and the mouth of the river has to be dredged regularly just to keep it open. Significant wetlands, river red gum forests, migratory bird species, and some really valuable ecosystems are in danger of collapse. And there's a whole bunch of dodgy accounting deals going on with prominent politicians weighing in.
You can't just sell people into destitution because of a belief of that the environment reigns supreme over all people's rights. Now, if you want to take all the water back, well, then take the water from Adelaide.
Walking away from the expert's advice and delivering as this will, less water for South Australia.
I call the Honourable...
But we're joined on this issue, which is standing up for South Australia and standing up for the River Murray.
It starts taking us 100 years to get this point. It took us one night to fuck it up.
Things haven't really changed.
Can I welcome our guests from the Murray-Darling Basin Authority to give evidence?
For too long, the Murray-Darling Basin plan has been a bun fight between different parties in different states. And
if it's not changed, then the lower part of the river, the Darling system below Bourke, I think will seriously die over time.
So now, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, better known as the ACCC, is on the case.
The Morrison government, meantime, has unveiled the terms of reference for the Consumer Watchdog Inquiry into the Murray-Darling Basin water market.
It will spend the next 15 months investigating Australia's $2 billion water trade and try to find out where the water and the money is going. Joining me for the live Politics in the Pub event to talk about the Murray-Darling Basin is Marianne Slattery. She's our senior water researcher here at the Australia Institute and a former director of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority.
Well, I thought we'd start with a bit of a tour of the basin, because there's a lot of people who clearly don't know a hell of a lot about the basin. And maybe we'll start with a bit of a tour around. And should we start at the north, Marianne? Of what's the north? When we say the north of the Murray-Darling Basin, where do we mean? What are the big issues, and what have been our big bits of work there?
Okay, you might have to remind me of all those questions as we go. But the Northern Basin, I mean, it starts up in Queensland, so we've got sort of the very southern part of Queensland. The Border Rivers forms part of the New South Wales-Queensland border. It flows down, everything flows into the Barwon-Darling River. which acts like a great big filter into the Murray. You've got several major tributaries that come into the Bowen Darling in the north, Macquarie River, Namoi, Gwydir, Culgoa River. But it's really interesting that whole, it's very, very flat, and naturally it would have just been a great big inland delta. And we talk about Australia being in flood or in drought. What we miss in that narrative is that there would have been water in the landscape most of the time in most of the basin. So in the north, you've got these very big rivers, more episodic, but you've got five weather systems that pick up all those tributaries. So the Bowen Darling naturally had water in it all the time. It was subject to very low flows and big floods, but naturally it had water in it all the times because you only needed one of those five weather systems to be working for water to come into the Bowen Darling. The Bowen Darling comes all the way down from the Queensland border, all the way down the western New South Wales, and comes into the Murray.
So it's very, very flat, and there's floods there pretty often. And one of the big issues has been floodplain harvesting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So the Basin Plan was brought in 2012, and it was meant to bring all forms of water take that we take out of our river systems and our water systems into a sustainable diversion limit. So we've figured out supposedly how much water we can take and have a sustainable environment and how much more water we need to take out that's already going to irrigation. One form of take that was had never been measured or regulated is floodplain harvesting. So in a system, I mean, everyone's heard of Cubby Station. You've got...
Has everyone heard of Cubby Station? Yeah? Oh, that's pretty solid. Okay.
You've got a very flat landscape that naturally is a great big inland delta, so you've got lots of water that frequently goes out of a river channel, across a floodplain, back into a river channel, lots of braided systems. And so Cubby, back in the 90s, just put up some relatively low levee banks to capture that water and re-divert it and put it into dams. What's happened under the Basin Plan is a perverse outcome where, in order to regulate this floodplain harvesting take, there's been a big rush to get floodplain harvesting operations licensed. There's actually been an increase in floodplain harvesting, a huge increase in floodplain harvesting, and it's about to be, licences are about to be issued for floodplain harvesting take.
So I guess essentially, and I know this is a word you've used a couple of times, we've sort of seen the cubbification, if you like, of a lot of the areas up there. The strategy of Cubby, of diverting floodwater into their own private dams, that's been pretty widely adopted up there.
There are now hundreds and hundreds of cubbies in the Northern Basin. Cubby itself is now complaining that they don't get the low flows into Cubby Station that they used to get because it's being taken upstream. That floodplain up there is the river. That's the river system. Just because it's not in a channel, it eventually ends up in a river and it has an enormous ecological benefit. Now, it gets worse because a lot of these structures, new structures for levee banks and dams, new dams, have been paid for or subsidised by the Commonwealth under the Commonwealth Efficiency Program.
We might talk about the efficiency program a bit later on, but maybe we'll talk about the most famous floodplain harvesting of all, the company that may or may not have had anything to do with Angus Taylor and Watergate, and perhaps our report on that.
So Australia Institute released a report in February last year called That's Not How You Haggle, basically around a sale of water from a company called Eastern Australian Agriculture to the Commonwealth as a part of a water recovery. That water was an overland flow. So there's several issues with this purchase. The purchase was for $80 million for around about 20-odd gigs of water, gigalitres of water, which is a huge price, and it was several times over the previous prices, the market prices in the region. That itself is probably okay, except the licences were for overland flow water. Now, when the water market was created, water was separated from land so we could sell water, buy and sell water. But water was never separated for overland flows, which makes sense. If you're buying your neighbour's, an upstream neighbour's water in a river, it makes sense that they sell you their water licence, they can't take it out of the river and it flows down to you. What doesn't make sense is an overland flow licence, because it's very specific to the piece of land that you hold. And so that water has never been separated from land. So the Commonwealth bought that water and there's no means, as soon as it leaves the farm gate, it's not protected. There's no legal recognition of that water.
So that was sort of $80 million for water that it then flows onto Cubby, doesn't it?
There was two properties involved. One was immediately north of Cubby, so that overland flow, if it's not captured at that property, would then flow into Cubby Station. If you could make a deal with Cubby, and Cubby have been pretty good corporate citizens in recent years, if you could do a deal with Cubby not to take that water, there's nothing to stop it flowing into the next property down. It's a pretty strange deal. And that gets worse because there was no water licence before the water was sold. The vendor advised the Queensland Department what the water licence volume should be, and they did the modelling and they did the negotiations. So, it's pretty unusual sort of.
So that's the northern, in a couple of minutes, that's the northern basin. It's very flat. A lot of it's based on diverting floodwaters. A lot of Commonwealth money has been wasted. Should we take our tour down to more the Darling below Bourke? Tell us a bit about down there and Broken Hill, Menindee, the lower Darling.
The poor old Darling in particular, which is Bourke Down, is in real strife for a whole lot of reasons. One, the increased extractions in the north because of floodplain harvesting. Water's just not getting into the Barwon Darling. Once it gets into the Barwon Darling water sharing plan was made just prior to the basin plan in 2012, and it threw away a whole lot of science, ignored a whole lot of science that was done years before to keep the Barwon Darling flowing. To the benefit of just two irrigators. Two irrigators own more than 90% of all of the water licences not owned by the Commonwealth in the Barwon Darling. The last irrigator is at Bourke, and we're just not seeing flows past Bourke. There was a Natural Resource Commission, New South Wales Natural Resource Commissioner put out an incredibly scathing report on the Barwon Darling water sharing plan just last week, and it's unlawful in so many ways.
Just for people who may not have a really good grip on the river's geography, I think it's worth highlighting. Essentially, the Darling doesn't flow past Bourke anymore. And for people who can't picture that, how long, roughly in kilometres, is it between Wentworth, where it hits the Murray, and Bourke?
I think it's about 1,000 k's, I think. A little bit more. But the Barwon Darling, always used to have some sort of flow in it. And if it didn't have a flow, it used to have lots of... It's, very sandy. So there'd be lots of, little water holes. Aboriginal people tell us that, if in the few occasions historically where the Barwon Darling dried up completely, they just go and dig and they'd create more water holes for stock, for kangaroos and stuff. So it's a pretty big deal. And it's, we've got hydrological connection, but we've also got an ecological connection. So all of our native fish, for example, spend some time in Menindee Lakes, which is at the bottom of the Darling River. Where we saw them, they're now saying 3 million fish died in January this year. All of our native fish apparently spend some time in Menindee Lakes and they migrate throughout the basin. So if we start to disconnect that ecological connectivity, we're causing real harm. Some of the ecologists are now saying we've actually probably reached a tipping point in terms of the ecosystem in the Barwon Darling. We've got no flows, much less flows coming into the Barwon Darling. We'll still get the really big floods, but we're not getting that low flows and medium flows that we used to have all the time. So that brings us down into Menindee Lakes. Below Menindee Lakes, we've got the Lower Darling. We had a really vibrant irrigation community down there. Menindee Lakes was basically... The northern irrigators hate Menindee Lakes. Broken Hills water supply relies on Menindee Lakes. And every time there was Broken Hills water supply fell below 18 months, the northern irrigators had an embargo on their pumping, which they hate because they're, you know, having to let water go past that goes to a community that's not even in the basin, that sits in these really big, big lakes in a very dry, flat landscape, and there's lots of evaporation. So they saw that as a waste, and they've been lobbying for many, many years to provide an alternate water supply to Broken Hill. That was provided, was finished last year. It was a real rush job. There was no environmental impact assessment. There was no business case. There was no cultural heritage done on that, but the pipeline was rushed through. But what that means is there's now no reason to maintain those flows into Menindee Lakes. And so the irrigators below Menindee Lakes have just been cut off. I heard this week that most of them are permanent planting, so citrus. I've heard last week that the last of those irrigators have just turned off the taps and have to walk away from those farms. This is all done by stealth. There's no compensation for these people. There's no compensation for the property owners, the business people of Menindee and those other townships.
But there was compensation for someone, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. There was one large cotton farm there called Tandow that was owned by Webster's Limited, which is come into water since the Basin Plan was implemented.
We allege no unlawful activity by Mr. Corrigan or any other director or staff member of Webster's.
Webster's bought Tandow in I think it was about 2015, but it was very close to when they sold water to the Commonwealth. They sold about 20-odd gigs. That was another $80 million transaction, plus the next year's water, which they got a $20 million cotton crop from. So they received, their water was valued at $26 million. They received the $80 million in total, plus the following year's water, which is worth quite a lot. They were the only people in the basin anywhere to get any compensation. Meanwhile, the all of the other irrigators and property owners in the Lower Darling have literally had their water turned off. And it's worse, the Barkindji have native title over an area that goes from Wentworth to Broken Hill. It's the largest and up nearly to Bourke, the largest native title holding in Australia. They won that because of their proven connection and ongoing connection to the river, and they've had their water taken away from them. And
So much scandal, so little time. But I guess one pattern that I've noticed in working with you, Marianne, and that you can definitely see in the Lower Darling, that when you look at issues across the Murray-Darling Basin in any detail, it suddenly becomes clear that this isn't about environment versus irrigators. It's not, you know, greenies versus agriculture. There's irrigators who are being hard done by as well. And I guess in my observation, it tends to be big, powerful, corporate, bureaucratic and political interests doing very well, and a lot of smaller irrigators, the environment and small communities, the Barkindji Indigenous people, doing pretty badly.
Yeah, this reform has definitely been at the expense. It's not delivering for the environment, and it's certainly not delivering for small irrigators and, you know, floodplain graziers and pastoralists. There's definitely there's a whole lot of people that have been really hurt through this reform, and it's really tragic, and it's really damaging to our agricultural sector as well. We're seeing this increasing lack of diversity. We're moving to two crops, cotton and nuts, and a lot of the nut plantations, which are dominating the south, are owned by foreign companies.
Let's keep our tour going quickly, but I'm keen to get to some questions. Yeah, let's talk about the Murrumbidgee, which, of course, was on Four Corners the other week, so it's a pretty hot topic at the moment. Let's talk quickly about the Murrumbidgee in the Southern Basin.
So the Murrumbidgee is one of our biggest rivers. It's one of the four biggest rivers in the basin. It gets a lot of snow melt. You always used to be able to bank on a near-to-natural environmental flow coming down every year because it couldn't be captured. There was no large on-farm storages in the Murrumbidgee. So there was this flow that was in excess to consumptive needs.
And we're sitting in its catchment here.
Yes.
You can see it from your house.
You can see it from my house. We'd get this near natural flow, and then that would flow down into the Murray and providing environmental benefit and economic benefit into the Murray, because it bolsters the Murray irrigators as water security. I've heard irrigators call that a disconnected river now, which is outrageous. You know, one of our biggest, best rivers in a reform that's meant to deliver more water to the environment is now being called a disconnected river. What you didn't get on Four Corners for the people that saw that is the scale of the changes that are happening in the Murrumbidgee. So in the Murrumbidgee, below, halfway down the Murrumbidgee, you've got an offtake, an irrigation offtake to the Griffith area to the north and to Collyambly area in the south. Below that, you start getting into the Hay Plains, which is as flat as the floor. You know, it was sort of wheat country, sheep country. It's a lot cheaper country because it's about 20% the price of irrigated land, I think. And cotton's moving down further south because we can grow cotton in colder climes now. So what the cotton farmers want to do, they've got a choice. They can buy up 5 rice farms because they need, you know, bigger tracts of land that have got small bays, they've got 5 houses on them, X number of sheds, etc., have to reconfigure the whole place for cotton. Or they can move outside the irrigation area into the Hay Plains, buy a wheat farm much cheaper, and then the Commonwealth is subsidising their new infrastructure on these sites through a project called the Efficiency Program, where they are building new dams. And when I say a dam, I'm not talking about the things that you see as you drive out to Murrumbateman. I'm talking about things that are like 9, 10 square kilometres. They're massive, 8 metres high, kilometres wide, cost hundreds of millions of dollars to build.
Would they hold a SID hub?
No, they wouldn't hold a SID hub individually.
No.
And they built specifically to capture this flow that was previously going to the environment and a great environmental flow.
They might hold a Lake Burley Griffin, though.
How much is a Lake Burley Griffin?
I think it's 40 gigs.
Oh, yeah, they'd hold a Burley Griffin, yeah. So there's lots of things to be... that I'm outraged in this. How can you have a water saving out of a brand-new dam? Why is the Commonwealth paying for these things? And the Commonwealth has spent years investing in improvements in irrigation efficiency, and that, say in the scheme, say around Griffith, and those people are having to sell their water to the new guys in around the Hay Plains, and again, Webster's is dominating that space. And it's really changing, fundamentally changing agriculture, because these guys are buying water out of the Murray that's supposedly for a water-saving project in the Murrumbidgee. So they're buying it off rice farmers or people that grow fodder to put onto cotton in a different valley on a new dam in a greenfield site, and somehow that's a water efficiency, a water saving.
Yeah.
So it's fundamentally changing the hydrography of the Murrumbidgee. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk really quickly about the Murray and SA.
So the Murray is in... is also in a bad shape, not because it's not getting enough water, but because... Under the Murray-Darling Basin Agreement, there's a commitment to deliver a certain amount of water to the South Australian border every year. That's hardwired in. So South Australians are, you know, often the biggest whingers about their water security. They have got the most secure water in the basin because of the Murray-Darling Basin Agreement. If you take the water... So that water has to be... That delivery has to be met 50-50 between New South Wales and Victoria. If you take the Darling out, because water's not coming down the Darling anymore, and the Darling used to provide 39% of the flow into the South Australian border, and you take the Murrumbidgee out, because we've got these big new dams, the New South Wales portion of the commitment to SA has to all come out of the New South Wales irrigators portion in the Murray. It also means that without those other two tributaries coming in, you have to push water down through the Murray at a rate of knots to get it to the border. Now, add on top of that a water market that's been introduced as part of these water reforms that moves water supposedly to its highest value use, and we've seen a huge increase in nut plantations at the around the border, also in the Murrumbidgee, but a lot of them down near Mildura area, the Sunraysia area. And they need water permanently. You can't turn off water to permanent plantings like nuts. So they can't, like, unlike rice or cotton that you don't grow if there's not enough water around, nuts need water all the time. So last year we saw water, the narrowest part, the biggest constraint in the Murray is at the top of the Murray near the Headwater Dam. And there's a forest there that used to be in pretty good shape because it was the narrowest part of the river that often be overbank flows and keep that wetland, you know, healthy. But what we're seeing now is a huge amount of water being pushed down through the Murray, having to go down through that forest, the Barmer Mirror Forest, at the wrong time of year, the time of year that the environment doesn't want it, causing a huge amount of, like, scouring because the volumes of water that's been pushed through. You're seeing scouring on the banks. You're seeing trees that are hundreds of years old collapsing into the banks, water going out into the forest when it shouldn't be there. You know, that's causing a heap of wasted water, which means that the irrigators that were growing rice and fodder don't have an allocation. Now, last year there was 1.5 sitharbs that went into the forest at the wrong time of year. That would have been enough for... we've got farmers that don't have an allocation. We've got a massive drought. We're getting fodder shipped over from Western Australia to keep dryland farming and our dairy farmers feeding their stock. And we've wasted 1.5 sitharbs through the forest and caused ecological harm and economic harm to those farmers and everyone else that relied on that feed to make sure that we had one, water to South Australia, but two, keeping these foreign-owned nut plantations alive, a lot of which aren't going to be producing for another 5 years. And we've prioritised those over fourth and fifth generation farmers, you know, upstream, who are walking off their farms. We're just about to see the end of the dairy industry in the basin. You know, like it's got months left of the people that are there.
So to summarise where we've gotten to, we've screwed up the Darling and it's not running into the Murray. We're screwing up the Murrumbidgee and it's largely not making it to the Murray. So we're having to put huge amounts of water down the Murray at times when it shouldn't be there. Wasting a lot of it as well, and that's a really key point. You generally think, oh, flooding a forest, that's meant to be what the environment's after, isn't it? No, it's been at the wrong time of year, and so we've been putting huge amounts of water down there for the big new nut plantations, but also for those, let's just get stuck in, those whingers down in South Australia. Let's have a quick rant about South Australia and then we'll go to questions.
Well, I'm a New South Welshman, so I don't have to hold back. So, you know, a really big driver around the Basin Plan and the narrative around the Basin Plan was the Lower Lakes, you know, and that sort of makes sense. It's the end of the system, so it's a good, you know, canary in the coal mine of what's happening. Under the Murray-Darling Basin Agreement, the control of water ends at the border, the South Australian border. So South Australia just basically legally does what it likes with water once it gets past the border. Now that includes environmental water held by the Commonwealth. The South Australians, you know, love their Lower Lakes. There's people that live there. There's, you know, it's a huge amenity. And they like to keep their lakes at a certain level over the summer, in particular for boating. There's a huge boating regatta down there. It's one of the biggest, it's the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere.
I've been known to boat myself, and I'll just pull you up there. It's the largest freshwater regatta in the Southern Hemisphere.
So the river operators are under a whole lot of pressure to maintain the Lower Lakes levels at a time when the environmentalists and the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder wants that water to be going out to the Coorong, where it's, you know, meant to go. And we've written a report, Coorongs Don't Make a Right, on some...
I came up with that.
We had an audit report that the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder did looking at risk to its delivery, and that singled out SA's management of their water because they're not using it. They're not using it the way the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder wants it to be used. They're using it to maintain water for recreation. So there's a lot of tension in the basin around the people upstream always point downstream, and you know, is that science right? But what, you know, science right around the amount of water that Coorong needs? But even before we get to a debate about science, I think it's, are they doing what they're meant to do? And they're not.
Are the managers of the Murray-Darling Basin doing what they're meant to do? No, they're not. I reckon that's a good place for us to wind up and see what people are interested in. So the lovely Hannah has the microphone.
My name is Julie Smith. I'm working here at the ANU, but I worked for a couple of years in the Commonwealth Environment Department in the water area in 2009-10. And my understanding from my work there at that time, when they were about to open up the market in Queensland without understanding the floodplain science, my understanding was that the Water Act, which governs all this, had as its primary purpose the protection of the environment. So hearing what's happened since then, I'm wondering, with the various stakeholders, including the environment, is there scope to take a class action, including on behalf of the river, as they have in other countries, to hold the Commonwealth and the states to abide by the law? Thank you.
Did you have your hand up when I said, has anybody used up water and down water in a sentence? I don't think you did.
I just think there's no end of opportunity for legal action. The South Australian Royal Commission that came out was like a shopping list for a whole lot of things that they found were not lawful. You know, there is a class action that is going against the Murray-Darling Basin Authority at the moment from irrigators in the south, related to negligence of how they're running the river, not related to the basin plan. But I just think there's a huge shopping list. The New South Wales Natural Resource Commissioner that released his report on the Barwon-Darling Water Sharing Plan just last week had another big list of things that were unlawful. So I think it's just a matter of, it's going to be limited by, you know, the class action participants and the lawyers, I think. Yeah,
I think it's a great question, and anyone who's interested in the lawfulness of some of this should definitely have a look at the SA Royal Commission's full report. You know, I guess part of it is, you know, it takes a lot of guts to lawyer up and take on the Commonwealth. You know, it takes a lot of guts to criticise any part of the basin's management, and the establishment behind it, you know, pushes back pretty hard, pretty fast. But I think it'd be great to see environment groups or other stakeholders, you know, looking into that.
Marianne, am I right in thinking Australia's the driest inhabited continent on Earth?
Yeah.
Okay. So given that, how have we ended up in this situation where governments allow water-intensive crops like rice and cotton and nut plantations to keep expanding? Because it just... I'm not a farmer, never have been, never want to be, but it just seems like utter madness to me. Can you help me understand?
I think the policy settings around how water is allocated previously, I'll speak for New South Wales, would sort of say, well, we'll have, you know, we want around 20% of permanent plantings and nuts and citrus, and we want 80% in annual plantings like cotton and rice. And there was a split in the type of water licences you get and the reliability you get between those two. What's happened with the water market is an incredibly laissez-faire market. It's got virtually no other regulation around it. When we opened up the water market, I think a lot of the narrative around this is, oh, it's going to be great because the water market sort of balances out the drought, because if you own a water entitlement and it's in drought, you sell your water entitlement to you know, permanent planting, you get money for selling your water, they get the water, everyone's happy. That's not what's happened. So the business model for nuts, which is a huge expansion, a lot of them don't own very much water and they're happy to buy it on the temporary market and just duke it out on price, which is what's happened. And if you're a dairy farmer, you cannot... So that's, you know, like a permanent planting, you just cannot compete. Their break-even point's about $150 to $200 a megalitre. We're seeing water being sold to $600 or $650 a megalitre. But the other really big problem we've got is speculators. So the speculators in the market, we know that they're pretty large. We don't know exactly how large they are because there's very poor transparency over the water markets. So I think that policies that were working in the past have sort of given way to the water market, and it's just opened up a world of hurt.
Yeah, I guess I'd just chuck in on that. Marianne, the Australian Institute, certainly don't take the position that a dry place like Australia shouldn't grow rice or cotton. I think if we had the environmentally sustainable level of take set properly, then farmers should be able to grow whatever they like. But I think your question was a good one. Why are we allowing the expansion of this at this time? And I think that's a real problem.
My name's Paul Adcock, and I'd just like to say thank you to you both for being here this evening and for having been to Badger Bates and Justine Mueller's exhibition over at the Belconnen Arts Centre.
That was a great exhibition,
Which was called Barker, the Forgotten River. Barker is the Aboriginal name for the Darling, and the Barkindji people are the people of the river. You mentioned that there was native title claim that after 17 years was successful. And as part of that, it's my understanding that there was meant to be cultural water for the Barkindji people. If I've got my facts wrong, please correct me later. But I'd be interested to know how you see people in Canberra here could perhaps support the Barkindji people who have no cultural water. I've been working with the people along the river there, and they refer to that cultural water as shut up water, because that was what was meant to keep them quiet. Mm. But they no longer want to be quiet, and I'd make an appeal here this evening to support those people. And I wondered how you saw the people of Canberra being able to stop what is basically like an ecocide in that part of the Darling River. Like, I've stood in the middle of the river and I came out with dry feet. Yeah. It really is dry.
It is really problematic.
And there's local extinctions happening as a result of it.
Yeah.
We did at the exhibition at Belconnen Arts Centre have Terry Butler coming along, and she expressed some interest in a legal action because it's in contravention of the native title rights that the Barkindji people have in relation to the Darling. I know that's been a rambling question, but if you could respond to that, please.
Do you want to talk a bit about cultural water first, Marianne, and what that is?
The New South Wales Natural Resource Commissioner, in his report on the Barwon-Darling Water Sharing Plan last week, called for cultural water to be allocated to the Barkindji immediately. It remains to be seen what will happen out of that. I think that the Barkindji are one example of a whole lot of people across the basin that are really suffering because of this reform. We're seeing people, floodplain graziers that are getting, not getting water that they used to get anymore. The people in the Lower Darling, the other people in the Lower Darling, we're seeing, people being hurt in the Murray, people being hurt in the Yanko Creek, Billabong Creek, which runs between the Murrumbidgee and the Murray. They're getting their water shut off. It's happening across the basin. And I suppose I don't really know what to do other than make people aware and hope that, people can at least become aware of the issues and,
So I guess just quickly, what can Canberra people do? I mean, obviously you can find the Australia Institute's research on our website and promote that. But, I mean, Canberra is in the basin. Our minister, that's a bit embarrassing, I'm not sure who it is, but we must send someone to MinCo. Engaging with the territory government here is useful. And if anyone lives just over the border, John Barilaro lives in Queanbeyan. Well, he's still worth talking to. I think putting it on the radar, I've certainly raised it with Canberra-based politicians, and they do like to say, I'll leave that in the hands of my colleague who represents us on water. But just putting it on their agenda, I think is actually really useful. And the question was, do you see any use in engaging with Shadow Minister Terry Butler, or I guess Labor more generally? Absolutely. I think Labor could really step up a lot more on this, and we hope to engage with them, and hopefully that'll happen. Let's grab our next question. Thanks, mate.
I'm not involved in economics or water science at all, but although water is clearly at issue, has work been done, or do you have a view on whether we're actually valuing the right thing in the market? Because you could always, value the price of having a cow, for example, which must have some relationship to the amount of water you use, or license the crops, which goes to, what you're allowed to grow. I just wonder if there is a better market, because clearly from what you've said, sort of trying to shufty enormous quantities of water around to the person who has the right to use them is not really physically possible, even if it's a very good idea.
Well, I think that we have to take a step back and say, what do we want our agriculture sector to look like? Do we want a diverse agriculture sector, or are we happy for, one crop in the north and one crop in the south? Do we want to have regional communities? Do we want to keep, fourth and fifth generation people on farms? And if we do want those things, then we have to have a really good look at what the water market's doing, because the current trajectory is we're not going to have any of those things. So I think it's a step back. We've let the water market dictate all of those policies for agriculture and what agriculture looks like, and for regional communities and for who's farming. I think we need to have that policy discussion, and if we're happy with, international companies, owning basically all of our water for nuts in the south, and there's more Australian farms in the north, but we're also seeing that amalgamation of farming in the north as well, but all for cotton, then job done, we're there, that's what's going to happen. But if we want something different, then I think we need to have a good look at that and then design policy solutions to create that different space.
Hello, thank you very much. I'm just wondering what your opinion is of the recent announcement of the $1.5 billion by Minister Littleproud of the efficiency measures.
I think the efficiency program has just been a major rort. There's two types of water that's recovered for the environment. One is buying water by the Commonwealth from individual irrigators directly, and the second way is through an efficiency program where we're supposed to identify a project that's going to save water that irrigation uses. So an example that's always used is you've got a channel that's leaking, so you line the channel and you've got less water seeping out into the ground and more water getting to irrigation, and then there's a saving, let's say it's 100 megalitres, and that's shared 50-50 between the Commonwealth and the irrigator. So the first way of buying water directly from irrigators was seen as really hurting regional communities, because the irrigator gets the money, they pack up, go and move down to the south coast, there's less production in the area, it hurts the rest of the town who get no compensation for that. So the efficiency program, the narrative around that is it's a win-win. The Commonwealth gets their water for the environment, and the irrigator stays in production and keeps producing, and that's great for the irrigator and it's great for the town. What we're seeing is, in an attempt to get the water that the Commonwealth has set as its target, they're accepting all sorts of projects under the efficiency program. So, for example, on Four Corners, we saw brand new dams on greenfield sites. So no one's been able to explain to me how a brand new dam that's 10 square kilometres in the Hay Plains is water saving. And it's worse because that irrigator in the Murrumbidgee is buying water out of the Murray, and the Murray irrigator is selling up and going out of business, and then the irrigator then transfers that water to the Commonwealth. So no one's even pretending anymore that the water saving project is going to generate a saving, because they're accepting water out of a different valley. And it's exactly the same as the Commonwealth buying the water, except we've got a middleman now with the irrigator that's doing the efficiency project. but they're getting paid 2.7 times the market price of the water to do that. So I just think the efficiency program's a massive rort. Doesn't generate real savings. I've been advocating for a long time that we shouldn't be trying to achieve the 450 upwater for that reason.
I'm glad we got upwater into the discussion. Now everyone can say they've been in a discussion with upwater. Let's grab another question maybe from that area.
Right, I'll be quick. In the 1990s, we paid a little bit extra for our milk so that a lot of the dairy industry could move to the Murray-Darling Basin. Dairy cows operate according to the laws of physics and chemistry. How much water they need, how much food they need. Market forces don't count a bit. What can we do to protect those lovely animals that look after our needs, and how can we stop these silly people interfering with the basic laws of physics and chemistry?
Go for it. Good question.
I think it's back to that question of what do we want our agriculture sector to look like in the basin? You know, we talk about it being a food bowl. The current trajectory is it's not going to be a food bowl. If we want a food bowl and we want a diverse agriculture sector, then we need to have a look at what the market's doing to that. And if we're happy for two products, then, you know, so be it. We'll carry on as what we're doing. But I don't think that Australians have been told what's happening. They've been told that we've got a food bowl. I'm not hearing any sort of, you know, in the public narrative talking about how we're going to protect these other industries like dairy and rice and fodder. Yeah.
I mean, you had quite a specific suggestion for a dairy industry plan prior to the election.
Yeah, one of the ideas was that under the basin plan, there's water set aside for... So South Australia gets a set amount of water under the Murray-Darling Basin Agreement every month, and they negotiated through the basin plan that if they couldn't use some of their water, they could defer it and hold it in an upstream dam. And they had quite a lot of water they had sitting in Hume Dam that was labelled South Australian water. There were reports of the South Australian government actually trading with trading water back into irrigation and profiting from their water that they haven't used, and profiting from irrigators desperate to buy water for stock. So my suggestion was we could use some of that water that's deferred for South Australians' needs and create an emergency allocation that could go for fodder. And there'd be enough there to have a, you know, modest amount of, just to keep people going, and then use that time to step back and have a look at what the water market's actually doing. And I think it's a really important point to remember. Basin Plan was born out of a drought in the 2000s. Basin Plan came into effect in 2012. In the south, this is the first year of the drought. We started 2017 with full storages. In a year, we're seeing the dairy industry being wiped out and the rice industry probably not that far away after. You know, I mean, that's pretty shocking for fourth and fifth generation farms that have weathered all of the variability that Australian climate throws at them. And if that's not an indicator of a policy reform that's failing, I don't know what else is.
And we've got a report on our website that goes into some of that in more detail, if you're interested there. We've got 5 minutes to go. We'll take one more question, then maybe I'll wrap it up. Where'd Hannah go? Sorry, I promised this part of the room that they would get another go.
Hi, I'm a irrigator down on the Murray River. And I can tell you, we do feel like refugees because we know that the water's not coming down the Darling, and we know that all of our water is going out to sea in South Australia or being wasted in evaporation ponds in South Australia. And the devastation down there, when it's not raining, the dairy factories that are built around the place and the value-adding, you know, oil crushing, flour mills, malt houses, you name it, they're all going broke. Some of those regions have up to 86% unemployment, And it's not just the economic travesty that's happening to a lot of hard-working Australians, but I can tell you in the last 12 months that 22 people have suicided down there. Another two in the last month, people I know. And it's not even the old blokes that have weathered all the storms and had all the fights, wrestled cattle all their life. It's the kids that just can't see a future. Not on drugs and not drug-related. But they're the type of social problems that are caused just by really poor management of a really bad plan and trying to force it, implementation of it into place where you've got no control over water metering even. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but every business I've been involved with, if you don't measure it, you're not managing it. And these dickheads do not even measure the water into dams in the north. They don't measure what goes into South Australia. They don't measure what goes out to the ocean. It doesn't matter. But they measure ours to the last metre. Just in our region, Murray Irrigation Region, which is an area on the New South Wales side from Mulwala down to about Swan Hill, we need 750,000 megs there to cover 750,000 hectares where we produce about $5 billion worth of produce for this country, and we get a zero allocation year after year, and we see it flooding through the forest and causing, you know, just ridiculous environmental damage to bloody gum trees that we played in as kids for years. 1,000-year-old gum trees are dying. Native grasses are dead because they've been underwater for 6 years out of the last seven. Even the Brumbies, I know they're not natives down there, but these Brumby horses that ran around those forests for years are all dead because they can't live on water and water alone. But they actually got more attention than the farmers, as did the fish, because people don't see the farmers as a dying race, but they are down our neck of the woods. And I'm up here on a regular basis representing about 2,000 farmers in my area, trying to get some of these idiots to listen to the fact that the basin plan is a disaster because it hasn't improved the water flow, it hasn't improved the water management. But that's the problem you've got. They won't admit they're wrong, and everyone wants to kowtow to the South Australians, the other end of the country, because they need their votes in the Senate. So that's the guts of it.
Did you have a question as well, Chris? Or I wasn't telling you to sit down, but... Sorry, I wasn't telling you to sit down. I was just we do have to kowtow to the owners of this fine establishment, and I know they're wanting us to wrap up. So a question, and we'll wrap up.
Sorry, Roderick, I'm not known you to kowtow a lot, but the question I had was for Marianne, the Four Corners program, which we all thought was really missed the mark. There was a follow-up letter from the 22 scientists, an open letter, claiming that you guys were all about trying to rip up the plan. And I just really wanted to question your thoughts on that.
Yeah.
So we haven't defamed anyone yet. Let's try and keep it that way, Marianne.
So there was an open letter signed by 23 scientists about a week ago. Saying that the recent Four Corners program was sensationalist. It included people that were trying to rip up the basin plan, or worse, a witch hunt for hard-working bureaucrats. and what was really disappointing about... And they claimed to be experts. So there was one academic on the program, Quinton Grafton, who was very academic at this university, who was very critical about the policy of the efficiency program, and conceptually it doesn't save water, because that example I gave you before about water leaking out of a channel, he's done a lot of academic work that's been internationally peer-reviewed that says, well, actually, that water, you know, does actually return to the environment. maintains groundwater. Sometimes it goes back into the river. It is going back to the environment. So he was critical of the policy of the efficiency program. This letter, criticised that notion. Now, that was based on a review that the Murray-Darling Basin Authority commissioned. They paid for a review by academics, but that review refused. They refused to have that review peer reviewed. So, in my view, that's not science. The science is a scientific process, and if you don't stick to the scientific process, it's not science. I call that a consultancy. That was the terms of reference set by the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, paid for by the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, and in my experience, having worked there for many years, probably edited by the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. All of the academics on there, or most of the academics, receive funding from either the Murray-Darling Basin Authority or the Commonwealth Environmental Waterholder. And sadly, the business model for academia relies on external funding, so they really rely on that funding. I'm not aware that any of the academics had done any academic work in the actual issues that were raised in Four Corners. So Quinton Grafton was talking about the policy that he believes is flawed and based on his research is flawed. I was talking about the implementation of the policy, which is being rorted, and none of the academics went to that. But I think it's it's nearly like if we criticise the Basin Plan, if you criticise the implementation of the Basin Plan, you're trying to wreck it, you're trying to tear it up. So we have to turn a blind eye to all of the maladministration and malfeasance. There's been fraud, there's been bribery, there's been water purchases for water that doesn't exist at hundreds of millions of dollars more than it's worth. There's governments, trying to cover this up. It just goes on and on and on. The only type of scandal we haven't seen is a politician receiving a brown paper bag full of money. And that's not to say it hasn't happened, but we just haven't seen it yet. So, it's pretty indefensible, the implementation of this basin plan. It's not achieving what it's meant to achieve for the environment. It's hurting a lot of people across the basin and causing real, real harm. And we're not allowed to talk about any of that because of this sacred cow that's the basin plan. And we have to, if we talk about the bad things that are happening, we're risking the whole basin plan. And I just find that a nonsense in a reform that's a decadal reform, that's $13 billion. Policy ideas that we had 10 years ago might have seemed like a really good, sensible, best policy idea at the time. The fact that we can't even question them now without getting called names is just astonishing in a public debate. The fact that we can't question purchases that have, hundreds of millions of dollars too much. And when we get the information about this through the Senate or through FOIs, it's so heavily redacted that you can't see anything. There's no transparency. It's quite extraordinary, I think, that we're in this debate that you're either pro-Basin Plan or against Basin Plan. And I think my assessment of that open letter is that it was a very politicised letter. Even though scientists signed it, I don't like to criticise scientists, but I don't think they were being true to the scientific process.
I mean, I think it's worth adding in. I mean, we're talking about an open letter that was signed just in people's academic positions at the end of it. What they didn't say, or what you had to email the universities to discover, is it included a board member of the MDBA. I mean, the Australia Institute has academics on our board, and they don't go around signing letters saying, actually, the Australia Institute's doing a fabulous job, without saying that they're board members. And I just think the disclosure around that was disgraceful, really.
Well, it was more than a board member. It was a current board member. It was a previous board member who'd been a board member for 9 years. It was the chair of MDBA's, independent scientific committee. None of that was disclosed in the initial disclosure.
Well, that's a nice depressing note to end on. That'll get everyone nice and thirsty, and hopefully it will drum up some more custom for our friends here at Badger & Co., Patrick and all the staff. Thanks very much for their support here.
That's been episode 37 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. It was recorded live on the 31st of July 2019 in Canberra with me and Marianne Slattery. You can find more analysis on the Murray-Darling Basin and dodgy water buybacks on our website, tai.org.au. Listen free to Follow the Money wherever you get your favourite podcasts, or you can listen online from our website. Marianne is on Twitter at MarianneSlatter1, that's MarianneSlatte, and the number one. My Twitter handle is at r_o_d_c, and the Australia Institute is at the Oz Institute, that's TheAus Institute. This episode was recorded live by Clayton McDonald, thanks Clayton, and produced by Jennifer Macy. The theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. You can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.